Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to a Big Heads Media podcast.
Tonight is True Crime Night number 2, as we discuss a bizarre kidnapping and some vigilante justice. It's Chowsilla, California and Skidmore, Missouri. All that and more on Small Town Secrets. And here we are for episode 5 of season 2 of Small Town Secrets. And just like episode 5 of season 1, we're going to do another true crime night. So both of the main segments are going to be some true crime stories that I've wanted to cover for a little bit. And I can tell, hopefully tonight is not going to be as annoying of a night as it seems, because I already have this tiny bug that wants nothing more than to just bask in the glow of my 4K monitor. I think he finally went away, or maybe I smushed him, I don't know. But hopefully he's out of the way, and the cat stays quiet, and everything will fall into place like it usually does. Tonight we're going to dig into two towns, two cases, both of very different stories, though. So far, like, the theme on True Crime Night is that it's just true crime. I don't try to go any deeper on the theme than that. First up, we're going to talk about Chowsilla, California, and the bizarre bus kidnapping that happened there. And I want to give a shout out to the Our Strange Skies podcast. The only reason I know about this story is because I don't remember which episode it is. I'll have to ask maybe and dig it up. It's an older one where he mentions this story at the very beginning of his show before he jumps into his UFO stuff. And I always thought that was a really interesting story, and I wanted to dig up all the dirt on it and do it on this show as well, so we have him to thank for that. And then we're going to talk about Skidmore, Missouri, and Ken McElroy, which has been making the rounds. There's a documentary that just came out about it on Sundance, which I was going to watch and maybe use for the show, but I didn't get all the episodes recorded, so I kind of just did some internet research on it and didn't really use the documentary. But it's like a multiple part documentary. It's very in depth and wonderful. And I'll link to something in the show notes so people can find it. It's called No One Saw a Thing. It came out just recently this year, like a month or so ago, on Sundance TV, on the Sundance channel. But those are our two main stories, and of course we have the local headlines, and we have some listener stories to finish it up. Not a whole lot of show notes for this one. We're just going to kind of jump into it. But first, we have a promo from another Big Heads Media podcast. This one is the Into the Shift Baseball podcast, so check it out and give them some support. I'll be back right after this.
Stay up to date with the latest in Major League Baseball with the End of the Shift Baseball Podcast. Are you tired of the same old way baseball writers complain about the new changes in the game? Well, this is not the show for you. The End of the Shift Podcast with a modern take on what makes baseball great.
And the ball will be hit into the shift. To get an out, it's only because of that shift. And they do! And that's why you follow the numbers.
Join co-hosts Max Gross and Kyle McArabee for weekly updates every Sunday night, or find us on Twitter at Into the Shift Pod. It's the Into the Shift Baseball Podcast.
The bug is back. I can't get rid of it. It's going to haunt me the entire show. I can feel it. Anyway, we have a couple of great true crime stories to talk about tonight, like I mentioned. And before we dig in them, I just once again want to let everyone know about the deal we have going with Dirty Knees Soap Company. If you are looking for some great handmade, like real soap and other kind of products like lotions, they've got beard oil, they've got body lotion, they've got hand lotion, they've got body wash, all sorts of great stuff and great scents. If you head over to stscast.com and hit the support tab, you can be directed right to their site. I will get credit for that if you do. And if you use STSCast checkout, you get 10% off. And I also get credit for that. So that helps out the show, and that gets you some great soap. So check them out. That is the Dirty Knees Soap Company. So all the great stuff is out of the way. All the rigmarole. Let's get into tonight's first segment on Chowsilla, California. Chowsilla lies in Madera County, with a population of 18,270. Its name is derived from the Native American tribe known as the Chowsilla, a Ute tribe. It is said that the name translates to murderers, which is a reference to the warlike nature of the tribe. Other than its interesting name, there's not much to be said about the little town, but in 1976, something did happen, something that put Chowsilla on the map. It would be a hot day on July 25th, 1976, as Frank Edward Ray, known to many as just Ed, was driving a bus full of 26 students. Ed was a farmer and a bus driver for the Dairyland Elementary School. The children, who ranged from ages 5 to 15, were all attending summer classes, and they were returning from a field trip to the local pool. At around 4 p.m., Ed noticed a white van on the side of the road. Assuming, like many of us would, that the van was broke down, he stopped to help. When he stopped, three armed men hopped out of the van and surrounded the bus. The kidnappers commandeered the bus and drove it to the nearby Berenda Slough, where they abandoned the bus. Then, all 26 children, as well as Ed Ray, were loaded into another van and driven 11 hours north to Livermore, California, which is just outside of the Bay Area, and that's what I always love pointing out to people that like have never lived in California before. Like, Chowsilla is in SoCal. Like, it's, I can't remember exactly, but it's around like LA and it's down in that part, San Bernardino, San Diego, all that stuff. It's kind of out there. And like, sometimes I know, like, for people that live in smaller states, it's so hard to fathom. Like, they drove for 11 hours and we're still in California. Like, it took them 11 hours to get from SoCal, the NorCal. They probably still had a couple more hours of California left before you get to Oregon, so it's a bit of a drive, to say the least. Once they arrived in Livermore, the kidnappers entered a quarry on the west side of town. Once there, the hostages were led one by one down a ladder into a buried moving trailer. Before they went down, the kidnappers took their name and a piece of clothing. They then buried the rest of the trailer into the dirt. While Ed Ray and the kids were buried in the trailer, the kidnappers made a call to the Chowsila Police Department, demanding a $5 million ransom. However, the lines at the Chowsila PD were busy and they couldn't get through, presumably because 26 kids were missing and everyone was calling the police department trying to find out what was going on, and probably the report of their kids missing. So what did they do? All three decided it was time to take a nap. While the kidnappers were off napping, Ray and the children were working on escape. The trailer had been supplied with food, water, and a bunch of old mattresses. Dousing themselves with some of the supplied water to fight off heat exhaustion, Ed and some of the older boys started stacking the mattresses. Soon they reached the top hatch of the trailer. I'm assuming this was the top hatch is where they were let down from. Ed then discovered that it was weighed down with something heavy. Using a stick and some grunt work, Ed was able to push off the 100-pound industrial battery that lay on top of the hatch. 16 hours after they were taken, Ed and all 26 kids escaped pretty much unharmed. Fred Woods, Richard Schoenfield, and James Schoenfield awoke after their much-needed nap to the news that all of their hostages had escaped and their plans were foiled. All three came from well-to-do families and had never been in trouble with the law before. Fred's father was the owner of the quarry, and the Schoenfield brothers were the sons of a wealthy podiatrist out of Menlo Park, which is where Facebook is at, if you need some sort of reference for that. The kidnapping idea started as a screenplay about the perfect crime. However, after losing $30,000 on a housing deal, the perfect crime started to sound like a good idea. It took less than a week to apprehend all three. Fred Woods would be found hiding out in Vancouver, British Columbia, up in Canada. All three got life in prison. Richard was paroled in 2012. His brother James was paroled in 2015. And despite many attempts at parole, mastermind Frederick Woods remains in prison. As for Ed Ray, the bus driver, he received a citation for outstanding community service from the California School Employees Association. February 26th, which is his birthday, has been marked Edward Ray Day in Chowsila. He would pass away on May 2012. All the children survived the kidnapping and were physically unharmed. However, many would go on to have nightmares of the event and other trauma well into adulthood. And that is, it's short and sweet, but it's such a bizarre kidnapping. Like, I guess it's grandiose for, I mean, if you're gonna grab 26 people, that's a good way to do it, is just grab a whole bus. You know, and so when I started looking at this, it was really interesting because I did not realize that they drove all the way up to Livermore, California. Like, and there's a weird synchronicity there. We'll get into that later into the show. And I always thought everything just happened in Chowsila and they buried, you know, it was very quick, but I don't know. I wonder where they got, it makes me wonder, like, how did they arrive? Like, we're going to go to Chowsila and grab a bus of people. I get it. It makes sense to go. Oh, we'll have to get these guys from far away. That way it'll put suspicion off of us. I don't know. Maybe they just drove until they ran out of gas or something. And we're like, all right, we're here. First bus we see, we'll go for it. That's what I've always wondered when I started researching this, was where did that all that come from? Like, why that town? Was there a reason for it? Was it random? They just figured, hey, we'll just drive far enough away from Livermore that it'll take them forever to pin it on us, and we'll be $5 million richer by the time this is all over. But it didn't happen that way, and, you know, just kudos for the kids and for Ed being able to get to MacGyver, to A-team their way out of that situation, and the kidnappers took a nap. They took a nap and they woke up in the news, to the news that just everyone had gotten out and their shit had hit the fan. It's a great story. And I know that I'm glad that, you know, everyone made it out alive, and I'm sure there was some baggage to deal with, but, you know, they were lucky and they persevered and they got through it. And that's the story of the bizarre bus kidnapping from Chowsila, California. So we're going to listen to The Boom, as we always do. And we're going to come back and we're going to talk about Skidmore, Missouri, and Ken Rex McElroy, and what happened to him. So, don't go anywhere. This is a podcast, not a radio show. You're not going anywhere. Be right back. And next we're going to talk about Skidmore, Missouri, and Ken McElroy. And I know this has been around, it's been on some other shows, and like I said, there's a documentary about it, a book's been written about it, there's been a movie made about it, there's been a Walker, Texas Ranger that I believe was based off of it. But the show's called Small Town Secrets, and this is a small town with a secret, so that's why I wanted to do it for this show. Skidmore is indeed a small town, with a population of 284. The local St. Oswald Protestant Episcopal Church is on the National Register of Historic Places. The town held a yearly pumpkin show, and that's pumpkin with an N and an apostrophe, not pumpkin, until 2004. It's not the pumpkin show or the historical church people whisper about when they talk about Skidmore. It's the shooting of former town bully Kenneth Rex McElroy. And as you will see, this story is the epitome of a small town secret. McElroy was born in 1934 to sharecroppers Tony and Mabel McElroy. He was the 15th of 16 children. He dropped out of school in the 5th grade and was mostly illiterate. Ken's early life was a tough one. As a young boy, he fell off a wagon. This resulted in a steel plate being put into his head. It was also said that when he was 18, a steel beam fell on him as he was working on a construction site. This caused him massive back pain and possible brain damage. Could these things have been a factor into how his adult life played out? I don't think anyone will ever really be sure. As he got older, his crimes grew more and more serious. He started off stealing things like liquor and antiques, and then moved on to livestock, such as cows and pigs. He made a living off of not just stealing, but leasing property he owned and raising dogs. He would go on to father 15 children by many different women. It was surmised that many of these children were a product of sexual abuse. He was a notorious womanizer and abuser. In fact, he would be indicted 21 times over the course of his years, and none of it would stick. His lawyer, Richard Jean McFadden, got him off each time. Throughout his life, he would be married, I think 3 times, maybe 4 times, depends on which thing you look up. His final wife was Trina McLeod, whom he abused and tormented constantly. Abuse she wanted to charge him for. However, when she was 14, he would marry her. Why? Because if she was his wife, she couldn't testify against him. He did this by bullying her parents into giving permission for the marriage, and then he divorced his previous wife to marry her. When Trina was 14, she became pregnant with McElroy's child. After giving birth, she fled with the baby back to her parents' house. Because of this, McElroy tracked her down and brought her back to his home. He would then later shoot her parents' dog and then proceed to burn down their house. Trina and her family would later say it was faulty wiring that led to the fire. This in itself is a great example of why Ken McElroy's wrath lasted for almost 2 decades. His intimidation, coupled with his Teflon-like presence in the courtroom, left the whole town feeling like there was nothing they could do. That was until July of 1981. Sometime in 1980, one of McElroy's many children was caught taking a candy bar from the local grocery store. The store was owned by Ernest Bo Bowenkamp, who was 70 years old at the time. Upon hearing about this, McElroy became furious. He drove to the store and made threat after threat, such as offering Bo's wife Lois money to fistfight her. He would stalk and harass the couple for quite some time. Then, one night in July of 1980, Bo was out on the loading dock of his store waiting for an air conditioning repairman when Ken McElroy drove up in his pickup truck. He got out of the truck with a shotgun in hand and fired at Bo, hitting Bo in the neck. Bo would survive, and McElroy would be arrested for it. This time, however, McElroy went to court. There was a new prosecutor, and there is some talk that he had bullied the original prosecutor into quitting, and they had to get a new guy. The new guy was David Baird. Baird, unlike his predecessor, would finally win a conviction against McElroy. He did this by lowering the charge from attempt to kill to knowingly cause serious physical injury. It was a lesser charge, but one that McElroy and his lawyer couldn't get around. Ken was found guilty and sentenced to 2 years, but he would be out on bail to await an appeal. This worried most of Skidmore. He was still out on the streets. In fact, he would be seen days later at the D&G bar brandishing an M1 Garand complete with bayonet, threatening to kill Bowenkamp. On July 10th, 1981, there was an impromptu meeting at the Skidmore Legion Hall, which was just down the street from the bar. The meeting was held by many townspeople and the county sheriff, Dan Estes. The townspeople wanted to know what they could do to protect themselves from McElroy, legally. Estes suggested forming a neighborhood watch. As the meeting went on, they got wind that McElroy had turned up at the D&G. The meeting dismissed and the sheriff left. Residents from the meeting crowded around the bar as McElroy was getting back in his truck with Trina in the passenger seat. Suddenly, shots rang out, hitting the truck. Trina jumped from the truck and was pulled to safety. McElroy was not so lucky. He had been struck twice by two different bullets, a .22 caliber Magnum and an 8mm Mauser. There were 40 to 60 witnesses to the shooting, however no one called an ambulance, and Ken Rex McElroy would succumb to his wounds. There were so many witnesses, however, to this day, no one has claimed to see who shot, and no charges have been filed against anyone. Only one man, Del Clement, who was part owner of the D&G bar, I'm assuming he's the D in D&G, was ever named as a suspect by Trina. Nothing ever came of this accusation, and Del would go to his deathbed admitting to nothing. On July 9th of 1984, Trina would file a $6 million wrongful death suit against Skidmore. It would be settled out of court for the sum of $17,600. Trina would pass away on January 24th, 2012, from cancer. She was 55. And I often wonder about this town meeting. It was, they said they got together to be like, hey, Sheriff, what can we legally do to take care of this guy? And the sheriff is like, well, you can form a neighborhood watch. And then all of a sudden some, I don't know, I imagine that some guy burst into the meeting hall and was like, he's down there, just down the block, you know. Probably didn't happen, but that's what I imagine. And, you know, but anyway, they got wind that he was down in the bar, like, as they were having this meeting. And so then the sheriff just kind of leaves. It's almost as if, though, like, he could smell that some trouble was a-brewing. And it was just kind of like, listen, everyone, you can form a neighborhood watch. That's a legal thing to do. But I'm going to get in my car, and I'm going to leave now. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, plausible deniability. I don't know. I just loved how he, like, left. I think if you were a sheriff of a small town, you knew that trouble was a-brewing, wouldn't you want to stick around after that meeting for a little bit? But, yeah. And there's a lot of discussion as to, you know, how many of these allegations and all these things that McElroy did, like, how much of it was true. You know, was he really that bad of a person? 21 indictments, you know, arrested like 52 times or something like that. You know, was it really that, or did this tiny town just have it out for him? Personally, I think he probably was not the greatest guy. And maybe some of that was trumped up against him, but I think mostly he made that bed and he ended up lying in it. And that's why I wanted to do it on this show. Like I said, it is the epitome of a small town secret. It is a town that has 284 people. I think there were, back in 1981, there's like 300 people back then. But still, that's tiny. I don't even know if that's a town. Wouldn't you call that like a village? And, you know, no one ever admitted. So many people saw this happen in broad daylight. Like, this didn't happen at night. You don't have town meetings at night, I guess. This happened during the day. 40 to 60 people saw it happen, were there, and no one has ever admitted to seeing anything. And to this day, there's been no charges filed. There's been no investigation. There's been absolute buckus. And no one knows, and probably will never know, who shot Ken McElroy. Yeah, there were two bullets, so they say, hey, there were two people. There are some theories that there were more than two people. But we'll probably never know or get any real answer or closure onto what actually happened that day in Skidmore, Missouri. And that is our main segment for the show. We're going to take a little musical break and come back and dig into some local headlines. And of course, we've got some news to dig into, some local headlines to dig into for this episode. And this first one comes from Coast to Coast. This is written by Tim Banal, and it's a watch as fleet of UFOs caught on film. An odd piece of footage from North Carolina shows several mysterious balls of light silently hovering in the night sky, and some suspect that the weird sight could have been a fleet of UFOs. The intriguing footage was reportedly filmed by William Guy during a ferry ride across the Palmetto Sound last weekend. In the video, he first films a rather picturesque sunset unfolding over the water, then turns his camera to a cluster of 14 orbs in the sky and asks, "What is that?" The astonished observer goes on to note that we are in the middle of the ocean on a ferry, and that there isn't any land nearby. Based on what can be heard by the chatter from the fellow passengers on the ferry, it would appear that Guy was not the only one who noticed the wondrous scene, as one person can be heard marveling that you only see that stuff on TV. In a comment on his YouTube page, Guy indicated the lights disappeared and then returned a few minutes later. As for what the anomalies could have been, some UFO enthusiasts have suggested that the footage shows a fleet of alien craft, possibly making observations on the planet. A less fantastic possibility put forward by skeptical observers is that the lights were training flares being used for military exercises. With that in mind, what is your take on the puzzling footage? And there is a YouTube video on here. I'll link in the show notes. You can take a look at it. It could be flares, but it could be not. I don't know. I don't think he has where he says they came back a few minutes later. I don't think that's in the video. It would have been nice if he would have, you know, filmed when they came back, too. That might have lent a little more credence to them maybe not being flares. But we just won't know, I suppose. And the next one is from, I got this from CNET. This is a mysterious fireball that crashed and burned. Wasn't a meteor, by Eric Mack. Last week, flaming objects were spotted in the sky over the island of Chiloé in southern Chile, before reportedly crashing to the ground and starting a series of small fires. Resident Barnita Ueda showed local Channel 2 News where something fell from the sky and burned some bushes on her property. Now, after a preliminary investigation, officials from Chile's National Service of Geology and Mining say they've ruled out a disintegrating meteorite as the cause, after failing to find any evidence of space rock at 7 points where fires were started. So what are they dealing with here? Just some superheated space junk re-entering the atmosphere, or is someone testing their space lasers on Chilean scrub? Technically, we're talking about unidentified flying objects. Yes, UFOs. Although nothing big or well-piloted enough to be reopened, the X-Files, for it would seem. After the story spread through social media last week, leading Chilean astronomer and astrophysicist Jose Meza told national broadcaster TVN the object was likely either a meteorite or space debris. With meteorites ruled out, that would seem to indicate it was a piece of old satellite or maybe a rocket booster that had roasted bits of Chile. The geologists who investigated the scenes told TVN they're performing a more detailed analysis of soil samples and will release their conclusions in later October. This could mean geologists found bits of metal that might indicate human-made space junk started the fire, but they're double-checking to see what type of material they found. It makes sense to ensure they haven't collected some other sort of metal or perhaps even a new element created by a far-off alien civilization that likes to announce itself by torching bushes. If that snark wasn't clear enough, it almost certainly isn't aliens. It's very rare for space debris to cause damage on the ground, as it usually falls in the ocean or remote areas. There have been occasional reports of rocket boosters doing damage falling in inland launches in China, but there are no reports of anyone ever being killed or seriously injured by space junk. And yeah, all snark aside, there's always some stupid like that in one of these articles, right? I mean, you just don't know yet. Let them do their analysis and see what comes up. And our final story is from the McDowellNews.com, written by Mike Connolly, and it is Bigfoot 9/11 posts photos of strange figures at Lake James. Members of Bigfoot 9/11 said they've captured images of a Sasquatch-type creature along the shoreline of Lake James just after 1 a.m. Saturday, and the claim is getting statewide attention. John Bruner, founder of the Bigfoot 911, said he and three other members have used a boat Friday night and past midnight on Saturday to scout some locations for future expeditions. They were on the Linville side of Lake James. "We were actually just scouting for new locations for searching Bigfoot," he said to the McDowell News. "The only gear we had were night vision cameras." Bruner said he had previously heard from witnesses who reported a howling sounds on the Linville side of the lake, so Bigfoot 911 thought it was worth checking out. "All of our research has been on the Catawba side," he added. The Bigfoot 911 members found a cove on the Linville side. When they got to the mouth of the cove, they turned their boat's motor off and let it float. "We immediately heard movement on both sides of the cove," said Bruner. "Then we started hearing wood knocks." Bruner and the other two had night vision cameras and started scanning the shoreline. "I immediately locked onto this creature and watched it for 5 minutes," he said. The creature was swaying from left to right, and Bruner took 121 pictures of it. The Bigfoot 911 members were all about 50 yards away from the shoreline. Bruner said he estimated the creature to stand 7.5 feet tall. "The whole time I was watching this thing, we could hear tree knocks, and this figure that I saw was not one doing the knocking. He said there had to have been three of them at least. After about 5 minutes, the creatures walked away, but the four members of Bigfoot 911 continued to hear tree knocks and whistling sounds for another 45 minutes coming from the dark woods along the lake. Bruner said that Bigfoot 911 intends to go back to that spot and do a 3-day expedition and gather more evidence. "The area where we saw this 5-mile walk from Paddy's Creek campground," he said, "the easiest way to get there is by boat." Bruner said that the others did not feel like they were in any danger during this incident. "Those things just want to be left alone," he said. The photos captured by Bruner were posted on Bigfoot 911's Facebook page. "I blew it up on my tablet and then studied the pics under an old-school magnifying glass," wrote Gio Johnson on Facebook. "Definitely a creature there. And in this pic, you can see not only a very faint outline of a face, but also of a second creature leaning out from the right from behind a tree. In my opinion, it's the real deal. It's no shadows." Another person was not so sure. "I think it's just where there was no foliage or trees, kind of like a trail or opening of some sort," wrote Christy Donson. So far, the Charlotte Observer, WBTV, and other media outlets across the state have reported the sighting. And there's a couple pictures on this website of them. It only shows, I think, two. What's the other picture? And I don't know. I mean, you can make out a head and stuff. But yeah, it also could be foliage. But I don't know. It would be nice to see some of the other, like, see the other 119 pictures. But their Facebook appears to be a closed group. I might ask to join it and see what's going on there and take a look at some of the other pictures. But that has been this week's local headlines. After the boom, we have a couple of listener stories, and then we're going to finish out this show and get ready for the next one. So the two listener stories that we have tonight have some fun synchronicities to them that I'll get into as we go on. The first one is from the Kanakanomicon podcast, and they told me about a local legend from their small town, and then I tried to Google it, because usually if you Google enough, you can find some little blog post about just about every urban legend of every small town. But I couldn't find this one, but I did find a recent news story that mirrors the legend that he told me about. So what I did was I kind of took what he gave me, the bits and pieces of the story he remembered in tweets, and I kind of put these tweets together to make a little paragraph here. And this is what Kanakanomicon told me. Whispering Waters Creek in Stony Plain, and this is in Alberta, Canada, where I grew up, has a bit of an urban legend associated with it involving a drowned kid, as small town creeks do. From what I can recall, it was more of a schoolyard story, something some kid came up with to explain why it was called Whispering Waters. The story that went around the schoolyard was basically someone died in the creek, and if you listened carefully, you could hear them whispering. Spooky old ghost story. And so then I looked up, tried to find that, and I found this local news story. It happened back in 2001, and this was updated in 2018. This is from the Globe and Mail in Canada. This is written by Jill Mahoney, and it's the accidental death of picked-on teen steers peers' remorse. Desperate to fit in, Giles Morrow was a bully's dream. The short, scrawny 16-year-old was easy to push around, throwing lockers and dumping garbage cans. And best of all, he would never tell. But since he was found dead, face down in a tiny creek earlier this week, teens in Stony Plain have been wishing they had treated him better. I even bullied him around a bit too, and feel kind of bad for doing that now, said 15-year-old Sterling Burroughs, who was briefly buddies with Mr. Morrow last summer. Mr. Burroughs, who placed fresh cigarettes yesterday on a mound of flowers marking the spot where Mr. Morrow died, said that she had tossed him around like a little doll because of his appearance and small size. Though Mr. Morrow's mother, Elaine, said she had received anonymous phone calls suggesting her son was not alone when he died, RCMP in Stony Plain, a community of 8,300, about 35 kilometers west of Edmonton, concluded yesterday that the death was non-criminal. The boy, who had been drinking with friends Saturday night, was last seen walking away from an elementary school near where he was discovered early Sunday morning by Charlotte Fraser as she walked her dog. Investigators who found a single set of footprints in the grass leading to Mr. Morrow's body believe he may have slipped and passed out while trying to step over Whispering Waters Creek, which is just 30 centimeters wide and 30 centimeters deep at that location. Mr. Morrow's family refused comment yesterday, but blamed his tormentors in a statement released before the police announced that foul play was not involved. In our son's attempt to be accepted and fit in, he allowed himself to be used as a court jester by fellow peers, sadly resulting in his death, the family said, pleading for an end to bullying. And on Monday, Mrs. Morrow said, "There's no way in my heart I believe he stumbled and fell into that tiny little wee creek." She said her son always refused to report his harassers. Just 5'2", skinny and self-conscious, Mr. Morrow resembled Harry Potter, the character in the popular children's novels. Though he was bright, the grade 11 student attended some special classes at Memorial Composite High School for help with concentration and social skills. Despite the soul-crushing regular ridicule he endured, he did a fair bit of picking on people too. The difference was that the people he harassed fought back and always won. It was kind of rowdy. He was a little guy that always picked on the bigger kids and always got himself in trouble that way, said 16-year-old Katie Edwards, who was in his social studies class. Mr. Morrow was often stuffed into filthy garbage cans and lockers, sometimes remaining confined for a couple of hours. He was also whacked on the backside with canoe paddles and belts. So it's a sad story. It's a sad tale of bullying and an accidental death, maybe. But it was just weird how the story, this modern story, reflected the schoolyard story that the urban legend that had popped up to just explain the why this place was called what it was called, and it mirrored it in such great detail. And the last story for listener stories, and the last thing we're going to talk about, is from Tyler Nelson over in Livermore, California. And if you remember, we just talked about Livermore, California. That's where the Chasilla bus kidnapping ended. And that's not the synchronicity. It is, but it's not the only one. So, right before I started researching these cases for the show, someone popped up on Twitter and said, hey, I think, you know, I just got done listening to the Hayward and San Leandro episode, and I think I used to eat at that In-N-Out that you were talking about all the time. So I found it on Google Maps, and I sent him a screenshot, and I'm like, this one? He's like, yep, that's the one. And then later, like the next day or something, I was trying to track down a book, something I might get into later, and all I had were like a picture of the page, or partial picture of a page, and I was trying to find out what this book was. And he helped. He didn't help. He actually found the book. He was like, hey, I did something. I found it. Here it is. And then later, you know, I'm researching the bus kidnapping. I'm like, oh, wow, this actually, a lot of this took place in Livermore, California. So I messaged them. And I'm like, haha, I'm researching the story, and it takes place in Livermore. And, you know, we kind of tracked it down on Google Maps where the bus, where the van, not the van, the trailer had been buried. And he went out there and he grabbed a picture or two of what that place looks like now. So I'm probably going to post that picture on Instagram and Twitter and all that great stuff when this episode goes out, so everyone can take a look. But Taylor has been quite helpful in the past week or so. And he wanted me to let everyone know about the local cursed Livermore totem pole. And I found a little article from Weird California. I don't see an author on this. Looks like it's an older website. But here's a little bit about the curse of the Livermore totem pole. The sewer system of the town of Livermore is cursed, and it's all due to their treatment of a totem pole made by Adam Norwald that is standing in Centennial Park on the northeast corner of 4th and Holmes. Adam forced an Eagle Norwald, a hereditary member of the Ojibwa Nation, originally carved the totem pole for a shopping center, but when they refused to pay him, he donated to the city for their 100-year anniversary in 1969. The totem pole is symbolic of 100 years of Livermore history, representing 1869 to 1969. Carvings on the totem pole depict the founder of the city, Robert Livermore. Atomic energy is also depicted in the totem pole. Each ring represents 10 years. The pole is 18 feet tall and was dedicated on May 18, 1974. However, at the time of its installation, city workers chopped off a few feet from the bottom of the totem pole. It is unclear why they did so, but Norwald considered the act to have been desecration of the sacred object he had built. He showed up before city council and demanded that they restore the totem pole back to its original height. His demands fell on deaf ears, and the city council refused to restore the pole, so Norwald cursed the city's sewer system. And 2 weeks later, the entire sewer system backed up. Livermore did eventually restore the totem pole to its original height, but they never issued an apology to Norwald, and thus, Norwald never lifted the curse of the town. The curse has showed up in other ways, too. In 1969, the Centennial Time Capsule was buried in the park, thus the name Centennial Park. But when it was time to unearth the capsule in 1999, it was nowhere to be found. The missing time capsule was eventually discovered, hiding right under the cursed totem pole. More recently, death has been attributed to the cursed totem pole. A documentary was filmed about Livermore's history, and of course, what's Livermore's history without featuring the cursed totem pole? It was featured in the documentary, and not only was Norwald interviewed, during which he reiterated that he had not lifted the curse, but also interviewed the former city manager and prominent city resident. Both the former city manager and prominent resident, according to the story, died a few weeks after the documentary was released. Victims of the curse, or just coincidence? Adam Forcing Eagle Norwald was also very involved in a variety of Native American protests. For example, he was the chief architect of the Native American occupation of Alcatraz Island from 1969 until 1971. Also in 1973, he discovered Italy. He showed up in Italy in full tribal regalia and announced the name of the American Indian people that was taking possession of Italy by right of discovery, just like Christopher Columbus had done. And there's a plaque on the totem pole, and this is what it reads. The totem pole carved by Adam Norrod, a dedicated American Indian, is symbolic of the 100-year history of the city of Livermore, 1869 to 1969. The carvings depict Robert Livermore, founder and protector of the village, the city's contribution towards harnessing atomic energy for peaceful purposes, with each ring represents 10 years of Livermore history. Dedicated to the people of Livermore, May 18th, 1974. And I think it's... I always wondered, like, so... A lot of people won't know. You always hear that expression, you know, the top of the totem pole or whatever, but it's actually the ones that are on the bottom of the totem pole are supposed to be more important, because I guess it's like they hold up everything else. So actually, by chopping off those 3 feet, did they destroy the real foundation, the real meaning of that totem pole? But that's what he told me about. That's what he sent me, and he has kind of inadvertently, I think, kind of become my West Coast correspondent almost. So thanks for the story, Taylor, and I hope your sewage isn't backed up, and I hope you have power and you weren't one of the people that are being forcibly cut off from power from PGE out there. But that has been this week's listener stories and this week's show. Once again, I would like to thank everyone for listening and supporting and just being here for the show. It's been great. If you have a listener story that you would like to let me know about, a small town secret to let me know about, there are a ton of ways to get it to me. I am on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Twitter and Facebook is at STScast. Instagram is STScast.gram. So you can hit me up on social media, give me a follow, give me a like. You know, you got a story, you can send it to me there. You can go to Reddit. I have a subreddit there, RSTS Listener Stories. So if you want to get on there and, you know, put your story on there for us to take a look at and discuss and put it on the show, we can do it that way too. You can also visit STScast.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the main page. There is an email form there that you can fill out and send me your story that way. There's a ton of other stuff on the website as well, such as all of the links and sources for this episode and all the other episodes, as well as pictures of what we've talked about. There is ways to support the show, such as the Dirty Knee Soap Company link. There is a link for merch on the show, so if you want to grab a t-shirt or a coffee mug, which I have right here with some apple juice in it, you can do that. There are also links to pretty much everything for the show. All the social media stuff at the bottom of the page. There are links for, like I said, social media, for iTunes and Spotify and Reddit. And all that stuff is at the bottom. It's the website. It's the hub for the show. You can find out everything you need to find out. A great free way to support the show is just tell somebody. You know, go, hey, I've found this great new show. You should check it out. Word of mouth does wonders. And just leave me a rate, you know, and review on iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use. All of that helps out the show. All of it gets out to more people. It's been a blast, and we are halfway through season 2 already. And, yep, we're going to have a big season finale, I think, this time around, maybe 3 episodes. But so we've got, you know, that's coming up pretty quick. But that's all we got for right now. So until next time, remember that every town has a secret. What is yours?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.